Welcome to Hot Yoga Radio. It's the autumn equinox and it's 2018, so it's September the 21st, I think that makes it. I'm having a constitutional in the rain today, as it happens. Never mind. There's a great need to get the body moving, so I'm going to put up with a bit of rain. In fact, I'm going to enjoy it. Might even call the podcast Walking in the Rain. What's on my mind? Strangely, it's still the state of the world, current affairs. It's a pain in the gusset. And there's a part of me that wants to retreat into some kind of ivory tower to think about the niceties of the Sanskrit grammar and vocabulary surrounding consciousness or the intricacies of medieval logic or the conundrums of being and so forth. But somehow this kind of crap that's going on all around seems to press in on me. Even though my personal experience of life is one of relative comfort and ease, and I do what I like, more or less, and I enjoy my friends, and despite the collapse of the British psyche along with the British economy that's going on all around, I find they're actually living in a peaceful town. Town's actually becoming peaceful because it's becoming a bit like a ghost town. More and more shops close up. It's all down to Amazon, I believe. Internet shopping. And seeing more and more boarded up shops and empty offices. And in the middle of the town, there's a really nice building, kind of Art Deco building, and it probably covers about a quarter or a fifth of the area of the town centre. And for years, it's been a department store. And it was held by a local family for some time, and then at some point got took over by the House of Fraser, which was a chain of department stores across the UK, which has recently gone pretty well bankrupt and been bought up by Sports Direct, which is a bit of a less genteel kind of enterprise. And I'm not sure whether the store's going to close or not. But it's like a ghost town in there. And stuff's being moved around. And for ages, the top floor of the store has been closed off. There used to be a bookshop up there and so forth. The basement where there used to be toys and kitchen equipment and computers and all sorts of stuff like that had been closed down as well. So the thing's been shrinking for ages. The writing's been on the wall for ages. So we could have this architecturally rather fine building in the town centre, just empty. I don't know what exactly will happen. But there's this sort of ghost town syndrome expanding. And I speak to people from other places and they say the same thing. And actually watch the YouTube video about the state of Warsaw, which is a town of similar size, part of the Black Country, West Midlands conurbation, 7 miles from here. It's the next town. And the report on the YouTube video was pretty much same's happening there as happening here. I don't think retail spending has gone down that significantly, or if at all, might even have expanded. It's just really is internet shopping, I think, is the thing that's going on here. And as we know, Jeff Bezos has recently acquired the status of richest man in the world. That's Jeff Bezos, who is the founder and the head of Amazon, which sells everything across the globe, pretty well. Certainly Europe and the US and Canada and so forth. And it started off as a bookstore, but it's branched out into a platform that small businesses can use and avail themselves of the Amazon accounting system that will take the money for them and keep track of orders and all that kind of stuff. You can be a small business affiliate as Amazon if you just sold widgets, and you could have a page on Amazon to sell your widgets, and Amazon searches would find your widgets and so forth. Apparently the contractual terms are not that great. Amazon keeps the whip hand, and of course they're in charge of the search, so they can weight the search algorithm to help people prosper who they choose will prosper. And say Amazon branches out into everything, including their food, as well as all kinds of household goods and electronic goods, cameras, computers. Pretty well anything you can think of, to be honest, you can get it there. For a long time, Amazon's policy was to sell quite a lot of stuff at a loss, or for very, very little profit, and it took the company a long time to come into profit. And this meant that competitors were really at a loss to compete. And the thinking behind that really was that what mattered was volume of trade, because volume of trade would translate across into value of the stock, that the stock would increase in value because Amazon was doing a huge amount of trade. So rather than orientate the business for maximising profits, you orientated the business to maximising the stock price. And it's on the basis of the stock price that Amazon's a trillion-dollar company and Jeff Bezos is the richest man in the world. Now, actually, this move in capitalism, away somewhat from its imperative to make profits towards the stock price, trying to increase the stock price, is something that's been going on for some time. It's a shift that's been happening, but certainly since 2008, 10 years ago, and the big crash, and we're just now on the 10-year. And as you'll recall, after the collapse of Lehman Brothers, the other banks were bailed out, and there was money pumped into the economy through quantitative easing, which is simply printing money and giving it to the banks. And that happened in Europe, in the UK, and in the US, and probably in other places. And but at the time, the interest rates were generally pretty low. So basically, if you're in the right place and you knew the right people, there was some kind of very cheap money available. And people, again, this is a rigged system. It's not available to Joe Bloggs in the streets. But there was two people in the finance capital community, if that's what it is, were getting this cheap to free money and using it to buy back stock or to invest in real estate. And such like, but in the case of stock buybacks, of course, this meant that the board of a company would buy back the stock from that had been sold to the public at an earlier point, at the point of an IPO, initial public offering. So they were buying it back so it became the property of the company again. With the result that they're in prices, the stock price. Now you think, well, why would they do that? Well, because the managers of huge modern companies, particularly tech companies, have all got as a part of their contract a quota of stock as well as whatever salary they get. So their net worth was increased by this manoeuvre. You can see how that works. You know, buying the stock back creates a shortage of stock available for trading, which, as long as the company looks to be doing well, and of course if it's doing a huge volume of trade like Amazon was, people are going to think, well, okay, it's doing well, but there's only scarce stock to buy, so that inflates the price. And of course the other thing is that contracts of CEOs and so forth of these huge companies that were doing this scam, would contain clauses that the annual bonus was linked to the stock price. So by inflating the stock price, they were going to up their bonuses. And some of these people have enormous bonuses, millions and millions and millions, pounds or dollars, very often. So you see, this quantitative easing, it didn't encourage the banks to lend to small businesses so that they would do productive work and employ people. The actual mass of people have actually found that their wages have decreased in real worth. And nobody's had a real wage increase at the working class, middle class level for years. And in some cases there's been a depreciation. So all this money that was used to save the economy, it didn't exactly do the kind of WPA thing that Franklin D. Roosevelt brought in the 30s of pump priming the economy with actual creative, productive projects like the Grand Coulee Dam and so forth, and the projects for artists to prettify the environment and paint murals, and just endless uses to which created money was put in order to, as I say, pump prime the economy. And that kind of worked because it produced jobs and it produced spending, and that therefore produced demand. And remember the 1929 crash really spiralled down and down, and the invisible hand of the market didn't stop the spiral, the death spiral, because demand had collapsed. Because laid off workers have got nothing to spend on products. But this quantitative easing in 2008 onwards didn't work like that. It didn't go into productive work for the most part. It went to finance capital as opposed to production capital or industrial capital. And was used to play funny money games, inflating stock prices with cheap credit. Because the banks were charged with distributing this money. And that's what they did. They did what favoured the banks. And remember, if a bank has got some money to lend, what it wants to do is it wants to make a profit. It wants to take interest on the loan, and it also wants the loan to be as safe as possible. So there's more inclination and incentive for a bank to lend money for property, for instance. Say, property in London, open to foreign investors, because the bank has the property as collateral. So if the debtor doesn't pay back the interest on time, and you know, eventually pay back the loan, that the bank can foreclose and seize the property. So it's kind of like they can't lose. It's a secure way, relatively, of doing, you know, the banking thing of lending to make interest. And of course, the banks therefore really were pumping money into real estate, which is why we've got a housing bubble in London, particularly, well, across the country, but particularly in London. But there's no real productive work has gone on. It's just it's a numbers game of creating bubbles and inflated prices, irrespective of any sort of use value. I mean, it might be worth a Chinese investor, a Chinese billionaire, to buy a load of property in London. And they don't need to put any tenants in it or any offices or anything, like, and leave it. Because with this pumping of the price, the stock price, you might say, it's exactly equivalent to stock price inflation. And then sell on in a few years and make money that way, riding the bubble. So it's reasoning like this makes you think, well, we know we've got this kind of housing bubble, but also the stock market is a similar bubble. This isn't to do with real value created by productive work. And I think I'm a bit Labour theory of value on this, to be honest with you. You know, real value is created by the creative activity of people, whether that is to produce a service or a good. But just playing with numbers doesn't add any, which I might rhetorically call, real value. And bubbles do burst, and the stock market has to pop at some point, sooner or later, given its current state. And the housing bubble similarly. Actually, the current director of the Bank of England is warning that Brexit will cause a pop in the housing bubble and a 30 to 50% drop in house prices, which will leave some people with negative equity, because they will have just bought a house on a mortgage. And if they want to move on, they're not going to get their money back. They're going to have to sell and still have a debt with the bank or the building society that's furnished them the mortgage. And this is the price is always paid by ordinary people, by little people, you might say. You know, the banking crash 2008, 2009 onward did wiped real wealth off the worth of ordinary individuals, particularly in the sense that wages didn't really increase. And perhaps in some cases dropped. Services were cut, which normally could have been free or subsidised, in healthcare, education, and so forth. So actually, there was a real siphoning off in this way of wealth upwards to the already very rich. Now, I have to tell you that Goldman Sachs made, I don't know, 30 odd billion out of the crash. And no bankers went to jail, and they got their bonuses because the fact that they've been bailed out on the balance sheet made it look as though the bank was doing okay. But you know, the people accepted the liability, but without any accountability by the banks to the people. Yeah, the banks are unaccountable, but the liability is picked up by the government, by the population at large. The net result through various routes is a trickle-up system. And they keep telling us that this system's a trickle-down system. If we let people get very rich, they'll give to charity and they'll spend the money, which will create jobs. People will want the services that the very rich decide to spend the money on, and the goods that the very rich want to spend the money on. It's complete bollocks. The whole thing actually works in exactly the opposite direction. And the figures, audited figures, are unequivocal about this. So, hence the tumbleweed. Well, it's partly why. That's why the town feels peaceful, because it's kind of like it's just going to sleep for the last time, it seems like, you know. The way some people die, they die peacefully. They just go to sleep, they just fade away. No twitching and screaming. If you're lucky, you get one of them. It feels like that, but it's that's what I say, it's peaceful. Now, it's the thesis of Michael Hudson, who is a pretty experienced economist, who in his early days did work for, I think he worked for Chase Manhattan as an economist, doing studies for them. But he claims he's a Marxist economist. Even though he didn't come across as any sort of like doctrinaire Stalinist, Leninist or anything like that, he just understands the economy from the point of view of production, from the point of view of labour theory of value, from the point of view of there being a dynamics of social class, economic class, not cultural class, economic class at work in the economy as well. Obviously all the cultural stuff feeds in as well, where you do have cultural notions of class, and of course you've got racism and all manner of varied manifestations of the very stark and abstract reality of economic class in operation. Obviously the real world situation is much more intricate and baroque than the abstract picture that you get simply from thinking about economic class, because there's always an overlay of culture, which is a real efflorescence on the top of what's happening at that kind of abstract level of exchange and production and relations of production and so forth. But Michael Hudson's thesis in a book called J's for Junk Economics is really that finance capital has taken over. It's more powerful and more formative than the capitalism proper, industrial capitalism, which produces goods and services through activity, through work. And it is a kind of a gaming of the system, particularly of the money system and the property system. In other words, all the stuff that we've just talked about house price inflation, stock buybacks and so forth, these are good examples of what he's talking about. Anyway, I recommend that for a read, J's for Junk Economics by Michael Hudson. The book's actually laid out, there's a few essays about some particulars, but there's also a dictionary of economic terms and the history of economics as well. Hudson's very, very strong on the history of debt and money, right the way back to the Babylonians, And his work's parallels that of David Graeber to some extent. But he's been researching this for decades. And it's good historical sense. Gives his work real credence and depth. And he's very good in his exposure of the Chicago School and Austrian economics and all of these bullshit inversions of Adam Smith's free market, a point that Hudson makes regarding classical economics, political economy as Adam Smith called it, is that Adam Smith was polemicising for a more level playing field for the new manufacturing capital that was rising up at the end of the 18th century when Smith was writing, over and against feudalism, which basically is rentier capitalism or finance capitalism, to do with owning land and getting rent income, passive income from rents on land. And the aristocracy had a lot of clout in the various legislatures and were able to sort of weight the system in their favour. So there was an internal tension within capital between finance capital or rentier capital based on land and typically the preserve of the old aristocracy against the new manufacturing capital, capital proper as Marx might have called it. And of course the modern situation, the modern Chicago School were at least their apologists and shills have really turned this on its head. They are trying to make space and freedom, free market, for finance capital over and against manufacturing capital or productive capital, which is turned on its head. Smith's project, whilst using his language as a polemical tool and to provide their cover story. So that's interesting, and you look into that in a fair bit of detail, and Hudson's very, very good on that. So things like that are on my mind at the moment. And people who like to hear me talk about yoga and the Yoga Sutra and stuff, it's not like that's gone away. It certainly hasn't. But it doesn't seem to be pressing in on me to talk about it. There doesn't seem to be much impetus to talk about that, really, at the moment, for me, personally. Except perhaps on a one-to-one basis and in the kind of the small and intimate situation of what we call, loosely call a yoga class. So I'm still on it. But at the same time, my eyes are roving around what's going on in the big bad world. Anyway, I hope that might be of some use or interest. Hold on, I'll repeat myself here. If you can get hold of Michael Hudson's J's for Junkie Economics, I would have a read. It's not, his work's not esoteric or difficult to read. And it might give you a bit of a handle on what's going down. Thanks for listening. Over and out.